Hello, and welcome back to Carry the One Radio. My name is Nancy, and I'm one of the producers here. I can't believe this is already the 15th episode of our Young Scientist Spotlight series. We've spoken to so many interesting graduate students, postdocs, staff researchers, and other early career scientists. Today you'll hear from my conversation with Gabby Keeler-May. She's a graduate student from the future. Just kidding. Well, she is in New Zealand, though, so by the time we were talking, she was actually already one day ahead. We talked about how an interesting course in scientific diving led to her current PhD, and we also discussed some of the invasive species of seaweed in New Zealand, as well as how we can make use of them. And finally, Gabby talked a little bit about being a PhD student who has already had many years of work experience. I hope you stay tuned and enjoy this conversation as much as I did.
This is Carry the One.
Carry the One Radio, the science podcast.
Igniting scientific curiosity.
From the University of California,
San Francisco.
I was so excited to hear about Gabby's story that I actually forgot to have her introduce herself. So I'll introduce her for you. Gabby Keeler-May is currently a second-year PhD student studying marine science at the University of Otago in New Zealand. She is looking at the ecological impacts of the invasive species Undaria pinnatifida, also known as wakame. Gabby grew up in Colorado, but her PhD led her all the way across the world to New Zealand. I'll let her share the rest.
When you think about it, like, Colorado's landlocked, right? And so it seems strange that, I don't know, someone like me would study marine science maybe, but you're just like, oh, just go west. And I actually went to school in California when I went to university. And so I studied at UC Santa Cruz. Yeah. So I was there. And I actually joined the scuba diving club when I was at uni. And so that's what really kickstarted everything, for me, I guess, into marine science. And even though growing up in Colorado, we didn't have the ocean, all of my science classes there were I don't know. They're kind of what inspired me, I guess. I had a teacher who she'd take us out to the rivers and we'd go sample little invertebrates and look at water quality things. And so I guess I could have been a freshwater ecologist too. But instead, when I just went to university and discovered this whole world of scuba diving and marine science, it was really my thing. I got quite excited about it.
Oh, interesting. So it was actually scuba diving that led you into marine science.
Yeah. So The scuba diving program in Santa Cruz is really popular. I think it probably still is. But when I first started my first year, we all the students that went to try out for the course, you have to pass the swimming test. And then they can only take on, I think, 20 students or something, just because your dive instructor can't be in charge of too many people, you know, because they have to watch you underwater. Yeah, I guess I joined it, passed the swimming test, and then got really lucky that I was raffled into the first class, and just that kickstarted this whole exciting path of just being underwater and having fun with these new people. And I don't know if it's the same for everyone when they first start university. It's kind of overwhelming and you're in a new place. And so just having that club of people and a bunch of scuba divers was really exciting. And then I started learning from some of the older club members, you can scuba dive for science too. And there's these scientific diving courses and you can learn how to do that and how to learn to do all the things that scientists do, but underwater. And so I was oh, that's so cool. And so, yeah, I kind of started, I guess, pretty much all of my 4 years at uni, just building up the qualifications to take that scientific diving course. Because you get credit for it. And there's the prerequisites for diving to learn that and do that until you can get into that scientific diving course. And so then I did that and just learned all about scientific diving.
That's great that you were so determined. Can you tell me a little bit more about what it means to do scientific diving? And also, what kind of lifestyle is it as a diver or a scientific diver?
Yeah. That's funny if you say as a lifestyle, I guess. Yeah, I guess it kind of is. Scientific diving is different from recreational diving a bit, I guess. Like, it still involves all the same. You need to understand how to be a recreational diver first and be safe underwater. And, like, especially, and I learned to dive in Monterey. And even here diving in New Zealand, it's all cold water. So, like, understanding how to take care of yourself if you're too cold, get out of the water. Or, like, if, you know, the ocean currents are really strong, like, not getting in. So there's all kind of that you take into account. And when you learned about scientific diving, it's kind of that and then amplified, because you learn about, like, how to take all of your research questions and bring it to figure out how to do it underwater. And so you kind of, it's like you kind of limit yourself, right? Because you have this question, but then you only have this certain amount of air to, like, go underwater and survey it and, like, or collect the samples or whatever you're collecting. So it involves a lot of planning and just making sure you have the right tools. And, you know, sometimes maybe if you forget something, or you have to, like, maybe figure out a different way because you're like, oh, I'm already underwater, like, my boat's far away, like, I'll either figure it out, or, like, maybe I just can't do that part of this survey at this time. And so it's like adding that on to all of the regular, like, parts of scuba diving, like, also being safe, checking on your buddy, like, making sure everything's okay. And so when you take your scientific diving course, you like learn how to do that, and then you just practice it over and over and over again until you're somewhat comfortable. And so I guess for me now, as like a PhD student, I kind of do that and get to like lead kind of groups into doing that. And so it's kind of, it's like, it's really scary because I'm like still a student, but also like getting to work on my research and my research questions. And like a lot of other people are helping me do that.
So can you also tell me, what are some of the tools you have to prepare when going underwater? I'm sure you have to get creative too.
Yeah, so it's not like, at least the work I'm doing now isn't, it's not like I'm not using any power tools or anything underwater. I know people who they like, maybe for some of their experiments are like using power, like underwater drills. But I'll just use pretty simple, like straightforward tools. Like I have to set up some transects that are permanent, and like I'll just like have my hammer and like my stake that I'm putting in, and like some concrete, like underwater concrete that I can like mix up and have prepared. And so just like bringing all of that, but like a lot of times it's just like bringing my transect tape and like the, like measuring out the distance of what I need to survey, and like a quadrat to like, you know, look at these certain areas or count certain things.
Wait, did you say transect tape? What is that?
Yeah. Oh, it's like a big measuring tape.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So how long are you underwater at a time?
So the dives that I'm doing right now, they're pretty shallow-ish, I guess, like 4 meters. So it's probably, I don't know, that's maybe like 15, 16. I don't know. I do everything in meters now. It's like 4 meters, 5 meters. Yeah. Okay.
It's okay. I think the rest of the world does everything in meters, so that's totally fine.
Yeah, okay, cool. I was like, it's like 4 or 5 meters. So we can actually be, I guess it depends on the person, like, and the project and what you're doing, and kind of staying within your dive tables too, because you can't be underwater for too long, because you get, like, that's part of the physiology, I guess, of diving that we learn about when you take dive classes, is like the nitrogen buildup. And like, you can't stay there for too long because that's not going to be good for your body. But yeah, usually, I think my dives will usually last about an hour is what we plan for. And sometimes they're a little less.
Once you're underwater and all set up, what happens next?
So when we do my, like, collections, I plot out these really big areas. And so we're doing 50-meter by 20-meter areas that are about, I think that's like 2 to 3 meter depth average. And so they're going in there, like within my plots, and just pulling out all the invasive seaweed. So we did that over a couple of days and ended up pulling out 12 tons of seaweed. That was just like, there was so much of it, and it was over. Yeah. So like, what is that? 12,000 like kilograms, I think. And it was over 5,000 meter squared, like these 5 plots, each 1,000 meter squared. And there's just like, we're all like, we didn't even realize like that's how much of it was there. And that's just small areas. Like, the whole coastline that we're looking at is 22 kilometers.
Oh my gosh, that sounds like a lot of seaweed. So how do you actually get the seaweed out of the water?
So there's a student, there's a master's student here before who he kind of started looking at different ways that we could do that. But yeah, he kind of, so he had set up these like just nets, I guess, that we could put everything in, and like the divers or the snorkelers would just like put all the seaweed in. So it gets pretty big. Like when it's an adult, it can be like 1 to 2 meters long. And so it comes off the rock pretty easily. If you need like a little knife, you can like kind of cut it off the rock, but we try to take the whole thing out, because if you leave any of the parts behind, it may still be a bit disruptive to the environment. And so we'll pull out the whole part, and like if there's any other things, sometimes little things, like they're like holdfast is like a little, I don't really know how to describe it. It can house like its own little community. And so trying to make sure like we leave what we can behind and only take out the invader. And so yeah, just pulling it out, putting it in these big nets, and then taking, like, then we have a little boat that's up next to us, and then just like giving that to the boat, and then they'll take that and contain it in something so that we can like take it back to the port and like crane it off the boat. And so most of it we're just able to compost. Like we have a big area that it can just go into compost. So we're also trying to figure out other ways that it can be utilized, but that's a bit like outside of my project. But there's definitely like, Andaria is like wakame, it's an edible seaweed. And so to like make this a system where we could like take this invasive out of the water and potentially like utilize it in other ways, there's like potential for that there too.
Interesting. So the Andaria or wakame can be collected and turned into food. That's like hitting two birds with one stone. You get rid of an invasive species while being able to manufacture a food product. But it sounds like you would need a lot more people to assist in the process, right?
So there's work, like you can be in the water doing things, but we always have people on the boat helping too, like captains driving the boat and the people who are operating like the cranes to move the seaweed. And then even on the like land side of it too, like processing the seaweed for like if it's food, you know, you need it to be food grade. So there's a whole, I don't really even know what all the other components of that are, but like then that could like spread on to, I don't know, the people who cook that food or make that food. There's also like beside it just being like food for human consumption, it can be like an additive to animal feed and agriculture, or even like fertilizer too. The soil in New Zealand is pretty like, I think it's lacking in nutrients. And so like adding seaweed is actually a really good additive for the soil here. So yeah, I think there's a lot of potential for it. It's just like, it's exciting to be like maybe on the ground floor and, you know, wondering what it could turn into.
Yeah, it sounds like there's so many different kinds of uses for seaweed. So what in your study so far and in your work with seaweed, what have you found to be the most fascinating facts?
Well, I guess just like overall, I mean, I think seaweeds are really cool. Like there's other people in our department that like, they do really amazing things with like Antarctic science or like marine mammals. Like those are all really cool, but I definitely have like an affinity for seaweed. And I think part of that is just like, they're like the foundation of the whole like food web and complex systems. And they like, you know, they do the same thing that plants do on land. Like they take in that carbon dioxide and then, you know, give us the oxygen to breathe and like put it in the water for all the animals. And so they're like really the building blocks and foundation of all of that. And that like in itself is just a whole big picture thing is very interesting for me. And they're just so pretty. I don't know. I always, anytime I go on a scuba dive, I'm like, what are all these seaweeds? Like I love cold water diving because the seaweed is like very diverse here. When you go like tropical diving is amazing and really colorful and there's lots of fish, but there's not any seaweed. There's some, but it's not as big.
So what are the different types of seaweeds?
Well, so there's like the big groups of like, there's like brown seaweeds, red seaweeds, and green seaweeds. I don't actually know exactly how many there are. I know the red seaweeds are very diverse, and there's seaweed researchers here and taxonomists who are still like collecting seaweeds and learning about these new seaweeds like in the waters here, you know, because I guess it's like logistically kind of hard to like collect some of these seaweeds and new things. So you'll like find these new things underwater.
What are the differences between the brown, red, and green seaweeds?
Outside of their like color, it's like the brown seaweeds are generally they're very big. And so it's the ones that a lot of times you'll see, like in California, it's the big like Macrocystis ones. And so they're kind of like the big canopy forming ones. And then there can also be lower level canopy ones. And then the red ones are, so the ones that I know of and have seen, they're like, can be really like branched and pretty and like almost like, I don't know, like lacy looking. But there's also some reds that are like, they can get quite big as well. So they're quite a diverse group of seaweeds. And then the green ones, there's like, I guess the most common one is probably like the sea lettuce that you can see like probably in the intertidal and the shore. I think, yeah, it's in San Francisco. I remember seeing it in the harbors there. And yeah, they kind of like all work together to like, I guess when you're thinking about maybe a forest and the big trees, like the brown kelps are kind of like the big trees. And then there's all these other like complex, like little things in the understory that are around them that kind of just add into the whole system and like fill the space.
So what are you hoping to learn from your seaweed research? What is your research question?
My question, like before I started and was planning it all up, was like, well, I want to understand the impacts of Undaria, which is this invasive brown seaweed that's here. And it's originally from Japan, but it's been here for about 30 years now. And like my current supervisor he's done surveys, and there's kind of been some surveys that have continued since he started those in early 2000 to like measure the density of it and like how much of it is here. But like seeing like the impacts and what it's actually doing takes such a long time to see, like when something shows up, it may not be doing anything right away. And so a lot of what my question is, well, how can we measure that? Because we look at the density, but we can also look at the way that this invasive seaweed grows. Is it's an annual, and so it grows really quickly. And so we know it's like biomass is really quite large. And so I've been working on a way to like figure out, okay, how can we measure that? And how can that help us understand what it's actually doing to like the underwater environment here?
We talked a lot about scuba diving and seaweeds, so many things I didn't even know about before. But now I want to circle back to your path to the PhD. Can you share a little bit about your decision to pursue the graduate degree?
Yeah, well, so I took a couple years off like between my undergraduate and before coming here. So I was in Santa Barbara for a little while working with a nonprofit there. We were looking at seabird habitat restoration. And so I guess that's kind of what got me a bit into like invasive species and restoration is that project, but it was like vegetative restoration. And so we were on land, like replanting the like native shrubs that these little seabirds, like they spend all their life at sea and then they come back to this island to like have their nest in these shrubs, but those shrubs weren't there for them anymore. So like their populations had declined. And so I did that for a couple years with a group off of Ventura, actually. And then after that, I was at UC Berkeley for a couple years and I was helping in the instructional biology labs. And so that kind of, for a long time, I was like, oh, I'm never going to go back to university. Like I was pretty good with my undergraduate degree and really happy with that. But then I was helping lots of students with that instructional like biology lab and like even working with lots of graduate students. And they're like, oh, you're pretty good at like all of this. You should really consider grad school. Like it's quite fun. And I was like, no, I don't really. Like that seems really hard. Like who's going to pay me to go to grad school? I don't need to do that. And they're like, no, like you'll really like it. I can just tell. So I had some people there that were like, okay, yeah, maybe I should start looking into it. And so just like looking, I guess, for programs I knew I wanted to do a program internationally. And then I did something kind of silly where I like looked at the distribution of the giant kelp, like that's in the Macrocystis kelp that's off the coast of California. And I was like, where else does that grow? And so it's like all in like Washington. And like, so I could have gone different places along the Pacific coast, but then it's also like the Southern Hemisphere distribution was like in Tasmania and then in New Zealand. And I was like, oh, I'll look at programs around there. It'd be cool to go dive in a kelp forest that's like similar to California, but actually quite different. And so that's what brought me to like looking at the University of Otago here and then finding my supervisor and working with like his whole group, because he does like most of the seaweed physiology and seaweed lab projects here.
I'm glad you got to find a really interesting advisor. So what happens after you find a person that you want to work with?
Yeah. Well, so first I sent an email out to my supervisor, Chris Hepburn, and I was just like, hey, are there, like, I like what you're doing. Are there any projects that I could work on? Like, this, here's my CV, you know, kind of, it's like kind of awkward, I guess, when you send out those emails, because you never know if anyone's going to reply back. Like, I sent other ones out too and didn't get replies really from any other people. And then he was like, oh yeah, like, I'm quite busy right now, like doing this teaching stuff, but like get back to me around this time and like we'll definitely talk about it. And so I was like, okay, cool. And I like put in my calendar like, okay, email him back at this time. And so and so I did that, and then he's like, oh yeah, cool, let's like have a Skype interview. And so we just like had a really like informal conversation like this, and he's like, yeah, like that's really cool, everything that you've been doing, like I do have these projects that in mind that maybe they would be good for you, like let's continue having conversations about this, and like maybe send me your proposal for what you think about this and what you could set up, and then we'll kind of go from there. And so it kind of, I guess, turned from that and like submitting like a more formal proposal and what I thought I wanted to do that would kind of go in line with his ideas of projects. And then he was like, yeah, cool, like let's submit your like formal university application, and you have to have like your advisor supporting it. And so he's like, yep, they'll like send it to me and just I'll like approve it. And so, yeah, it was that process was pretty straightforward, I guess, but it was also very scary because it's just like you're just all online doing it, right? Like I'd never been to New Zealand. I couldn't like just like pop into the international or, you know, the student office or whatever and just be like, hey, I want to apply here. You know, I'm just like having conversations on email or Skype. But yeah, and then eventually it was like, okay, you're accepted. And then like the visa process took a little while and just like sorting all that out.
Yeah, visas are always a pain. So how long did the entire process take?
I think it was probably, maybe it was like 8 or 9 months. It was nearly a year, but not quite. Yeah, because then I pushed it back a little bit because I was like, oh, I want to save a little bit more money and like travel a little bit too before I actually come down there and do school. So I think I pushed it back maybe like 3 months. It could have been a little faster if I had wanted it to.
Well, I'm glad you got the opportunity to travel. That's always such a great thing to do if you have the opportunity. So how did you feel coming back to university after working for a few years?
The first few people I met were like, they had gone just like straight from undergrad into their like master's or PhD. And I was like, oh, that's quite different from what I've done. And like kind of, you know, I guess a bit of imposter syndrome maybe. I was like, oh, I did it wrong, like I'm too old to be here, you know. I'm like, but then you like meet other people and who are like the same age as you or even older, and they're like, oh no, like that's totally fine, everyone's story is different. And so it's nice to like have those people who make you feel a bit more confident and like, no, it's okay, like what you're doing works. But yeah, it's definitely weird when you're like, yeah, I was actually like working for 5 or 6 years and then decided to come back to university. And some people are like, oh yeah, I haven't like left school yet. And so I kind of feel bad for them sometimes too, because they'll ask me about it. They're like, oh yeah, maybe I should take a break. Like, it sounds nice what you did. And I'm like, yeah, well, there's definitely that opportunity there. And like school will be there when you want to come back to it.
That is so true. And that's the whole point of our Young Scientist Spotlight series. It's really to showcase the different paths into graduate school and into science. Well, Gabby, that is all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me, and I hope to see you in New Zealand someday. It sounds phenomenal.
I know. Everyone should come to New Zealand. It's so good here.
This episode was produced by me, Nancy Kai, for my closet. Music is Palms Down by Blue Dot Sessions. The interview was originally conducted in August of 2020, and since, Gabby has been busy with fieldwork and has even organized an online conference. Great job, and good luck to your studies, Gabby! This episode is made possible with the help from our Patreon supporters, Sama Ahmed, Carly Van Orstel, Janine Cuevas, Samantha and Kana Esselman, and David Cabral. Thank you so much for your continued support. If you would like to help us provide accessible science to everyone, then please donate to our Patreon at patreon.com/carrytheone. Your support allows us to transcribe these interviews and purchase audio editing subscriptions so that we can deliver quality episodes. But if you're unable to donate, no prob, we totally get it. Feel free to share our podcast with your friends and family. You can also follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, or reach us at carrytheoneradio@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And as always, you can find more episodes at carrytheoneradio.com and subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you listen. Thanks for joining us today, and I hope you stay curious.